This is the Fighting the Good Fight podcast, defending taxpayers and solving their tax problems with your host, Patricia Gentile. Patricia Gentile is a taxpayer defense attorney, CPA, the founder of New England Tax Relief, and Patricia L. Gentile Coaching. With 40 years of IRS expertise and experience, she has successfully defended and resolved difficult IRS situations for hundreds of taxpayers. Patricia coaches tax professionals to confidently identify their client's IRS problem and create a successful resolution plan for them. As a fierce advocate, a creative strategist, and solution finder, fighting the good fight with Patricia Gentile is both her passion and purpose to help tax professionals successfully resolve their clients' tax problems.
Welcome to the Fighting the Good Fight podcast. I'm your host, Patricia Gentile, and today my guest is Catherine Tindell. She's a CPA. She's the founder of Dominion Enterprise Services, a specialty CPA firm that works with other firms and their clients to claim complex tax credits. Catherine's expertise has been featured by Intuit and the Journal of Accountancy, and she has had over 10,000 professionals attend her continuing education seminars. That's exactly, Catherine, what I wanted to talk with you about today. Your recent webinar, I attended that, and I was in awe about your discussion and the detail about the due diligence that preparers, tax pros, and CFOs, that due diligence checklist, coupled with your webinar and the tool you had, I wrote it down here, it was a revenue eligibility estimator tool. You coupled those three, doing your 1 hour webinar with the free download of a due diligence checklist and that access to that revenue eligibility estimator. That was just powerful, powerful information for anyone who would like to be proactive and escape the coming ERC nightmare, as you titled your webinar. It's Escape the Coming ERC Nightmare, Tax Pros and CFOs Due Diligence on Third-Party Claims. Before we get into that, though, I think listeners might want to hear the update with this employee retention credit program and possibly the volunteer disclosure program, because since you actually did this webinar and now we're past March 22nd, can you give us an update and a feel for the landscape about both these programs now, the ERC, and we're coming up to the April 15th, 2024 deadline on year 2020 claims. So could you give us some overview of what's going on?
Yeah, so basically with this program, you know, as your listeners are probably aware of it, but just a little background on it, this is the COVID era employee retention credit. Had a ton of advertising coming from every direction, people trying to do this work. And at the same time, we've gotten a lot of press from the IRS about just the dangers of filing for this inappropriately. So it's a program that has a lot of money on the table for businesses, but at the same time, the way it was rolled out to the public and the way that it's being administrated, there's just a lot of rules to it. And because it's within the tax code, there's a lot of tricky pieces that go into it just because that's the environment that it lives in. And so with the program in general, even though it's back from tax years 20 and 21, because it's a tax credit, it's filed for on amended payroll tax returns. It has a slightly different statute of limitations than normal income tax returns. And so for 2020 claims, the due date for those is April 15th, 2024. For the 2021 claims, which for most businesses, that's where the bulk of the credit usually is, just because the program was beefed up in 21. The 21 program deadline is April 15th, 2025. So you have another year for that year of the program to file for. But that being said, you know, recently there was legislation passed by the House that's awaiting you know, voting in Congress that would retroactively, as it's currently written, would retroactively end the ERC program as of January 31st this year. But it's a big unknown whether or not it will pass. The tax bill in general has a lot of statutes in it that are retroactive in the current filing season. There's key politicians who don't want to support it. And then on top of that, just given the timeline, you know, as the time we're recording this, Congress is currently on their spring break. And then the filing deadline for regular income taxes is April 15th with some retroactive provisions in there. Just administratively, it's going to be kind of a nightmare. So it's unclear what's going to happen with it, but that could retroactively end it. And then on top of that, we've been in a very unusual environment with the IRS where earlier this, you know, past September, the IRS announced a moratorium on processing ERC claims because of their concerns about erroneous filings, which I think are very justified from my practical experience, how many erroneous filings I see and just some of the advertising I see versus the reality of how the program works. So they paused processing claims back in September, and that pause is still in place. They've only recently announced that they're intending to end the moratorium on processing claims late this spring, but they haven't given us a deadline for when they're actually going to resume the processing of claims that were filed.
I remember when they announced the moratorium, they were saying, go ahead and keep filing your ERC claims because the April 15th, 2024 deadline was not going to change for getting those claims in for tax year 2020. So if I'm understanding this correctly, the moratorium hasn't been lifted.
No.
And they have all these in the pipeline that came in that they were telling you, go ahead and file, make sure you get in by the April 15, 2024 deadline for the 2020. So they're going to have this outrageous backlog.
Oh, they do. It's well over a million returns. I think they're over like 1.5 million by now where they're backlogged. The taxpayer advocate, which is, you know, kind of oversees the IRS with certain administrative things, said that they have a backlog that includes pre-moratorium returns, which were not supposed to be subject to the moratorium, but they have been in practice. And they're just, you know, they're just not processing those either. So they've got an immense backlog and, you know, at 1.5 million returns, if they're having to spend, you know, 10 minutes per return, how many man hours is that? You know, it's just, it's going to be crazy for them to catch up. Unless they get significant software involved, which I think is, there's been hints that that's kind of what they're doing. But, you know, it's just, they're kind of a black box. They're not really giving the profession much information about what's going on.
And is this what the taxpayer advocate has been talking about in her report to Congress?
Yeah, it was one of the top points for their annual report to Congress was the delays in processing times of returns.
What's your experience of those that you submitted and filed prior to September 14th of 2023, prior to the moratorium? For example, if you filed somebody last spring, have they been processed?
So we were seeing last year, we were seeing about a 3 to 4 month turnaround from, you know, they got pretty quick at processing them last spring. And then right around, so September was when they announced the moratorium. They had actually stopped processing returns before that official announcement. A couple of weeks before, it was kind of unofficially they had stopped. And so I had returns that were in, you know, May and June of last year that hadn't hit the processing yet that were still waiting. And I expect it to be, you know, those people will have waited a year to get their funds back, you know, from a legit, you know, totally legitimate claim, just stuck waiting. You know, it's kind of, I tell people, you know, at least the IRS is paying you interest on it, but it's, you wouldn't be in as comfortable a situation with them if you owed them a significant tax balance to just sit on it for a year, right? So it's pretty unreasonable treatment what they've done. You know, I totally understand their concerns with the erroneous filings and the threat that that poses to the tax system. Absolutely. But that's more just an administrative challenge rather than just a complete shutdown of a processing of a, you know, of a tax program. Right. So it's, especially for this duration. You know, it's one thing to close it for a month. It's another thing where it's been September. They said they expected it to go to the end of the year. And now we're recording this at the end of the March, and there's still no, you know, official start date again. That seems like a pretty egregious position for them to take, where they just have decided to stop. But what I will say, though, is their intent was to curb erroneous filings in the program. And I get the sense, just being on the ground, it seems like it's been successful, because some of the known bad actors that I'm aware of that were pretty large operations with, you know, hundreds of employees have laid everybody off. So you can see that I think it has had that effect of, it seems like it's curbed some of those bad actors in the space. But at the same time, I've got businesses and nonprofits who are really counting on this money, you know, especially in the current economic environment. And it's really frustrating for them and frustrating for me to say, you know, I just don't know. I don't know when they're going to pay you. They don't know when they're going to pay you. You know, we have no idea when it's going to be, but, you know, hopefully soon. And the day that the program was ending, which is on the 22nd, we're talking about the voluntary disclosure program for people to be able to, basically, if you had a quarter that was filed for the employee retention credit that upon further inspection, you did not believe that you're actually eligible for it, you can return 80% of the funds back to the IRS, no interest and penalties, kind of no questions asked. They let you keep 20%, you know, assuming that you had to pay some kind of contingency fee to get your work done, to try to get people to square up, because they're just up against an impossible administrative burden with trying to catch everybody that was erroneous in the space. So that's what the program was. And, you know, they closed it as of the 22nd. And the day that the actual day of the deadline, the IRS upload tool broke because they were getting so many submissions. So it's, they were able to fix it later in the day. But I think it just goes to show that it was, you know, it ended up being a lot of people last minute ended up doing it, just because for a lot of people, they had to get their tax professional involved. It was really ill timing from the IRS to put a deadline for this program right after a corporate tax deadline and right before the individual income tax deadline, for something where it, you know, it takes a lot of due diligence for a lot of people to get to the end of the question of, you know, was I eligible for this program? Yes or no, to the full extent, especially if you're looking at 2020 quarters. That's a very nuanced question. So it's, and a lot of tax professionals don't have a lot of experience in really fleshing that out. So it was kind of an unreasonable thing that they did with that, having it be such a short window. But I think it was a very successful program, and they've indicated that they may reopen it again. I think that they're probably going to have to, in order to get tax professionals in the position to really help their clients who inappropriately pursued the program to get compliant again. I think that's the only way the IRS is going to get this thing under control, is really getting the tax profession on board and getting companies on board. In order to do that, they have to have some kind of amnesty program like this to get people to, you know, return the money and not face the interest, you know, not face the interest and penalties that are really intensive for, you know, underpayment of payroll tax.
I agree with you about the timing. I don't think the March 22nd deadline for this voluntary disclosure program should have been even in the middle of tax season, period.
No, and when it first came out, I messaged my stakeholder liaison. I said, hey, this is putting a lot of you need tax professionals buy-in for this to work. And this is going to put way too much pressure on tax professionals to try to administrate this, because that's really who needs to be doing the work with the client. The client doesn't know. That's why the client filed a bad ERC to begin with, because they don't know. And you're not going to get the tax professionals to be able to do anything, because you're catching them at their absolute busiest time of the year for, you know, regular income tax obligations, which they can't just drop the ball on that. They have to get those filings done. So I think they will open it up again. I think the success of the program will spur them to open it up again. Obviously, it's going to be less generous terms than what they did at the initial round. You know, when I've done calculations for people of, you know, what's the worst case scenario if the IRS came back and audited you and pulled all these funds back, when you consider things like the current interest rate's 8%, the underpayment penalties are just, they can get really, really high really quickly. And then by the time you have things like, you know, if you get audited after the statute of limitations expires on the additional income tax that you paid related to the credit, you lose that, you're whipsawed out of that. You could be looking at 50% of the credit that you got in addition to having to return the credit when it comes to the interest, the penalties, the representation fees, et cetera. You know, so having something where it's going to at least mitigate some of those pieces of it through a voluntary disclosure program is going to get people back on track. And I think that's what the IRS wants. You know, most of all, they just want people to get back on track, and incentivizing people to do that and incentivizing the tax profession to be able to help with that is the only way it's going to get resolved. I think for a lot of, you know, my current feedback to people is, even though the VDP, the voluntary disclosure program, ended last Friday, you don't want to kind of wait for a new one to start to get yourself back into compliance, just because we don't know if that's going to happen. You're racking up interests and penalties. And, you know, when I see some of the things from the IRS with, you know, very recent, just today, the CI department posted a, you know, we got a guy for $1 million of tax fraud. You know, I see ERC cases all the time. I've had several where people were overclaiming by, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars. I had one that was over $1 million. It's very easy to get yourself into hot water. You know, if this is a big announcement for them that they got somebody for, you know, $1 million of tax fraud, this program is going to blow that out of the water. Because even small organizations can qualify for a lot of, if you filed for the maximum amount that the program allows for and it was erroneous, you're already getting close to that. You can get close to that territory very quickly, and you're playing with fire. So you really don't want to wait to get yourself back into compliance or wait for an inspection. Or I've had people that have said, oh, well, you know, if they don't think we're eligible for it, they'll come back and they'll tell us and we can just give the money back and we'll be friends again. And I'm like, that's not how the IRS works. You know, you can't just make, you know, okay, maybe we qualify, maybe we don't. We'll just put it in a bank account and see what happens. That's not a good position to take. And I've heard people say that, and it's, you know, it just shows that they don't really know what it's like to be on the other side of, you know, an IRS enforcement, which, you know, I'm sure you can speak to that. It's not pretty.
This is what showed up for me on your webinar. It really was two different types of red flags. Mm-hmm. One was if an ERC was filed by the client is coming to help them correct possibly an incorrect filing. And the other red flag was if the CPA or the EAs or the CFOs actually prepared and filed for a client, I would tell everybody listening, your due diligence checklist is spot on. The nuances behind each item on that checklist, if somebody says, yes, that applies to me, they've got some due diligence to do behind that and understand just related party organizations alone was a whole area there. And if it was a non-revenue claim based on supply chain disruption and the supporting documentation, including a state order, I saw your example of the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, the governor's state order that had to be obtained to add that in. Tell us for what reason maybe somebody just want some other set of eyes, a second opinion to review the claim they did just to make sure they didn't file, you know, an erroneous claim.
Yeah. And this is something that our firm does for other firms just because we have a specialty with it. But I would say, you know, when you have a client that's approaching you where they had the work done by a third party, and that includes payroll processors, I get a lot of work from people where the payroll processor pushed the client to do the filing based on the client just filled out a questionnaire. And, you know, the client, they're asking questions like, do you need to be an aggregated filing? How's the client going to know what the aggregation rules are for this program? Most tax professionals don't. Or, you know, when did you have government disruptions? people don't understand the nuance of what's going to qualify and what doesn't. And they say, I was disrupted the whole pandemic. Okay, great. File for the whole pandemic. You know, that's kind of the level of the shenanigans. And, you know, so if you have a client that's coming to you and has a claim, I would say the first thing is, you know, just as a tax professional on my, you know, my experience with income tax work is, you know, the larger that claim is, the more is at stake for that client to lose in terms of an adverse situation. And so I would put more scrutiny on larger claims. I'd put more scrutiny on, and that's the most common error that I see, is people will do these filings under the non-revenue qualification, and they'll try to use something like OSHA standards, which the IRS has already said doesn't work, or, you know, oh, well, there was, you know, it was recommended, you know, by the CDC that everybody stays home. And the IRS has already said recommendations are not a mandate. Recommendations are not a prohibition. And we're looking for a prohibition. So how can you tell if it smells bad? It's usually, I would just assume any claim that's really large that you weren't involved with needs to have some due diligence just as a protection measure for the client. Because, you know, the worst case scenario is a couple years after the fact, whoever was the person that was processing it for them gets picked up, your client gets picked up, your client paid income tax on this, and now your client's wrapped up in this thing and the money's, you know, they've spent the money. You know your clients well, you know how their business operates. Were they really that impacted during the pandemic by government orders? Were they having to modify their operations because of how the government was interfering with them? Or, you know, you can use, we have that revenue tool that was mentioned that is a great quick resource for you can just plug in numbers from their plug in the gross receipts from their P&L and see, okay, does this like look reasonable based on what I can see? And you get that sense of if it smells bad. But I think for every practitioner, you know, the IRS has called this out as a responsibility for us, where they've said it's a circular 230 requirement, because when you file for an ERC, you have to also file amended income tax returns. So you're going to have clients that'll come back that have an ERC and now they're needing amended income tax returns. And, you know, they've said you're going to get kind of wrapped up into this and you need to do a reasonableness check before you file those amended income tax returns, whether or not you were involved in that original filing. You know, in general, for a lot of us, we're the one professional in their life who's going to understand the real risk they're up against with something like this. They probably are unaware of, you know, the true risks of doing a program like this inappropriately, and then the IRS coming back to them, because when you submit filings, you're saying to the government that this information is correct. And so that's why there wasn't a lot of scrutiny before they were doing these big payouts, because, you know, technically on the books, you taxpayer are saying that you are owed this money and you did your due diligence and you read all our rules and are telling us that we owe you this money, so we'll send you the check. That's the mechanism. The burden of proof is on you as a taxpayer, not on them to disprove you for something like this. And people don't realize that that's what they've walked into. And it's very easy to screw these up. And the other really common one that I see, especially for smaller businesses where you might have, you know, people who own multiple businesses, you know, they're multiple entrepreneurs with multiple small businesses, that they may have needed to aggregate and actually were not eligible. And that's super common. I see that all the time with people that they did a filing. And when I talk to them and ask them about their equity structure and ask them about other businesses they might have, oh, actually, you needed to aggregate those two businesses together. And when you aggregate those revenues, you're not qualifying anymore. Or when you aggregate those revenues, you're actually qualifying for more. But you don't know unless you're getting into the weeds on it. So it's a very tricky program.
Well, that's what I loved about your webinar. I can't believe you were able to discuss the getting into the weeds aspects behind your due diligence checklist. You covered that amazingly just in a 1-hour webinar. And I want our listeners to know that this webinar was free and you can get a CPE, one CPE credit as well. And you pointed out a quarter could even be askewed. Yep. That you based your calculation on, your revenue qualifying calculation on, just because either you or your accountant did year-end adjusting entries to account balances in the last quarter.
Yep.
At the end of the year. And you actually have to go back and look and see what really should have been the date. Mm-hmm. That could change the difference of an ERC claim for that particular quarter, up or down.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's a lot of weeds behind that due diligence checklist that I want my listeners to know that I've referred my clients to you and your firm to review them for qualifying for ERC. I talked to you about one of your first cases a couple of years ago of a friend of yours who had a corporation in New Hampshire who actually used one of those, I would say a mill. Would you agree?
Yeah. Oh, one yeah. Yeah. They weren't tax professionals doing the work.
Right. And actually tell the story about that.
Yeah. So that was an interesting case. Another instance of, and just as part of the red flag saying, if you have anybody who said they qualified under a supply chain disruption, like all the red flags go up for that, because I don't even know why they allowed for a provision like that, because it just confuses people. It almost never applies to people. But so that's what had happened to this particular organization, where they had been approached by a mill. They had a claim that was, it was well over $1 million. And then when we went back and corrected it for their actual eligibility window, it ended up being they only qualified for about $200,000. So it was about $1 million overstatement. And the reason for that was the mill was trying to say that they qualified under supply chain disruptions through the entirety of the program, when in reality, they couldn't get supplies because of the general economic disruptions of the pandemic. There was no government order preventing them from getting the supplies for what they were doing. So when it's a general pandemic disruption and it's not coming from a specific government order that you can lay your hands on, then you can only qualify under the revenue declines. And luckily for them, we were able to get it reversed before the IRS had paid those funds out. But if they had not sought that second opinion and they had spent that money and they had approached us years later after seeing, the numerous warnings from the IRS about, the warning signs of bad ERC claims, and, started to get nervous about this and looked at it again, it would be a much messier situation to try to clean up, especially after paying a high contingency fee to this mill that's now, headed for the hills. Like this one in particular has laid off all their personnel, so there's nobody to go back to.
It's perfect timing for what you're talking about to ask you, what do you see as the audit risk at this point? And if I'm understanding this correctly, for example, the April 15th, 2024 deadline for the 2020 ERC claims, is that start the 3-year statute for examination of these claims that are being filed?
Well, they're trying to get the statute extended. So in the current legislation that's pending, there's an extended statute of limitations in there. And I think even if that doesn't pass, I think the IRS will be able to have enough push with the government, with legislation to get some kind of statute of limitation extension, because they're not going to have enough time, even with a 3-year statute of limitations, to get back to everybody. And I think for them, it was interesting for me to see the figures that they had posted recently on the bulletin with how much they've already picked up in the criminal investigation department, because I think that's where a lot of their initial efforts are going to be in, because those are just, you can easily show the bad intent and, them trying to recruit those funds before they're gone forever. We're just starting to see now more activity with the inspections, and they're focusing on the really large claims first and the things that are obviously fraudulent. But they will trickle down, I think, to, more regular businesses, because for a lot of businesses, I was just talking to somebody yesterday, fairly small claim in the realm of this program, had a $80,000 ERC credit. And I said, how often is it that you have a transaction with the government that's $80,000 for a small business? That happens never. And so for them, if they're trying to recoup as much as they can from enforcement efforts, that's a big red target. Where else, you might have, people trying to write off their mileage on their car, or trying to, pull little fast maneuvers on their tax returns. It's getting nowhere close to $80,000, So, it's a real, I think it's going to be a real area of interest for them. And I think it's a learning curve for them. The initial approach that they seem to be taking is, I think they're going to be going on a practitioner by practitioner basis, because if you've got somebody who is filing supply chain, qualification for one person, they probably were doing it for everybody. So I think that's going to be their approach. And with the voluntary disclosure program, a big part of that program on the back end of it was disclosing who was the original filer, what were the services, what's their contact information, that sort of thing. I think the cleanup operation is going to take a while. It just depends on, I think another key factor that needs to be weighed is that, with the recent IRS budget increase, they're going to have more resources to go after things. But at the same time, they're trying to manage their political capital at the same time. And for them to jump down the throats of innocent business owners and put people out of business over this is not going to look good for them. So there's going to be an element of, they might have some more mercy on smaller people just as a political move, but as a business owner, I would not count on that. It's like, you want to be square and not let them have any recourse to meddle with you. But what will they actually do? It's really hard to say at this point. I don't even know if they truly know at this point, just from the, the information that I get.
Yeah. It sounds like, though, that they may have enough low-hanging fruit right now that they can go after.
And I think to another point with the, they've got a couple of years, they've got more of a budget. Who knows if they will actually implement some automated computerized systems to do some of this work. It's something that if I were them and I were having to tackle this, knowing what I know, that would be the first thing I would do is, okay, we've got business income tax return information. We know what this company's NAICS code is. We know where they're located. We can see, is it reasonable for a lawyer in Florida to claim 6 quarters of this credit? No, it's not reasonable. All right, we're going to check that one out. It's things that they could, basically run some statistical analysis to pick people for selection, because if they're seeing, okay, year over year on the business income tax returns, they were making more money. We can see what their gross receipts number is. Probably not revenues. And if they're in Florida, probably not government orders either. They probably don't qualify for this. So it's a simple data analytics exercise. And, if I were them, instead of investing the money into the personnel to make it a human process, a couple pieces of software that you can hire out an outside contractor to put that together for them internally to do that data analytics, it could be an automated regime for a lot of this. It's just, it depends on what they decide that they're going to do and the level they take it to. But there is a lot of low-hanging fruit for them right now, but I don't know what their plans are in the future. And that's why I think, having something like a voluntary disclosure program where most of the work is getting pushed back to the tax profession is really the only realistic way that they're going to get it done. And I think, for the tax profession, it's something where we're already administrating a lot of how things work. Yeah, we do the filings to the IRS. 99% of your clients don't get audited every year because how the code works, how to do the filings, you do the due diligence, the work's done right, it's submitted to the IRS. They trust that the work's done right. We're in a voluntary system. And I think it's going to get pushed back to that status with this too, where we're in a voluntary system. It's going to have to be the tax profession that makes it work. And so, you as a tax, for the tax professionals listening to this, it's another thing on your plate that you don't want to deal with, that you don't know how to bill a client for. But at the end of the day, it's almost like the Corporate Transparency Act changes. It's like, it's something that we're the one person in that client's life that's going to know that something needs to happen here, whether you do it or you find somebody else to do it for them. It's a unique position as a tax professional, especially with smaller organizations, that they need to be aware of what's going on. They need to be aware of the risk.
at this point, without a voluntary disclosure program, if somebody knows that that was an incorrect claim, what can be done at this point?
So I would say, you know, a couple of options, because I have a lot of tax professionals where they did the claim and it's mostly right. It's just a matter of getting the substantiating documentation together while it's still available. So things like going back, getting the government orders, getting proof of the nominal impacts, things like that, where the claim was generally right. It's just a matter of being safe for the audit. So that's one crew of people that we help that I see commonly. The other is tax professionals where, you know, the rules were very unclear in the midst of the program. So a lot of times when I talk to somebody and their tax professional had done a filing, you know, there's a kind of apologia that I do for the tax professional when I'm talking to that client separately, where I tell them, you have to realize this is the way the government rolled this out to the tax profession. You know, I don't think your tax professional wronged you by this needing to be corrected. It was just a very messy situation from the government. And certain things like the related party rules didn't get clarified until well into the program. And so it's very easy, especially for claims that were filed early on, to have errors in them just because the guidance wasn't clear. And so, you know, I would say as a tax professional, like, don't feel like you're throwing yourself under the bus by admitting that the government made it a messy program, you know, and that you were just trying to help the client. And, you know, now that we know more and we know what the IRS is doing and things have been clarified, it's the time to get it corrected. But we work on those as well, of getting people, you know, because at the end of the day, the program is still open, you know, assuming that Congress is not, as you're listening to this, Congress hasn't passed the current legislation. At the end of the day, you're just trying to get the credit amount to be right. You know, if you underclaimed, you can claim for more. If you overclaimed, you need to return the excess. And then that's the first piece, is get the claim right. So, you know, you'd file additional amended income tax returns. If they haven't processed the claim yet, so it's still in an unprocessed state and you want to withdraw a full quarter because it's incorrect, you can do the withdrawal program to withdraw that quarter, so the IRS will not process it. Which there's, if you just go to irs.gov and you just type in withdraw ERC, it's the first thing that shows up, and it's a simple process to withdraw a claim. You want to get your filings corrected, and then once you have that, you want to make sure that all your substantiating documentation is in place and you have all of that ready to go, just because a lot of the pieces that are involved with the substantiating documentation, if you're going to get audited 2 years from now or 3 years from now, chances are your state's website with those government orders may not have those government orders publicly available anymore, as they've updated their website since COVID's been, you know, at this point, we're in 2024, years ago.
That's perfect advice, actually, at this point. As we're talking about this, the IRS seems to be learning as they go.
Exactly.
About this whole program.
Yeah. Well, I've had IRS personnel attend my webinars. I've had them reach out to get more training, you know, so it's, they're learning too, because it's a really complex program. You know, a lot of tax professionals have really struggled with it. And, you know, on the IRS side, you know, they've had a lot of personnel turnover over the last couple of years. And so a lot of the people in the program that are doing the inspections on these are not super familiar with the tax code in general. You know, they, what I've been hearing from a lot of attorneys who've been dealing with, you know, inspections, is that they're having to do a lot of education of IRS personnel in the midst of these examinations, because it's a very complex program, which is unfortunate. I think it really does fly in the face of the spirit of what the program was supposed to be. But I think it's just a lesson for all of us that, you know, maybe tinkering with the tax code, it just ends up layers of bureaucracy make things more and more complex.
They've tied this ERC into the tax code as a result of having to amend payroll returns and income tax returns, instead of making it a program like the SBA, you know, like the SBA administer it, like they did with PPP and the EIDL.
Yep. And that was my recommendation of, you know, if I were them, I would skip the tax code and I would do something like a grant program for a program like this, just because a lot of the nuance and problems are from areas that were left gray that the IRS then had to go back to the existing tax code to make interpretations, like do related party wages count? And they had to go back and they made their own interpretations based on the existing tax code versus if it had just been a grant program, you can ignore that. You know, you can just decide in the spirit of this program considered a loan, should related parties count? And obviously, you know, on my side of it is absolutely they should have counted, you know, in fairness to taxpayers, because you're trying to help small businesses. Small businesses are usually family owned and very often. And now you're going to punish them for hiring their kids versus a bigger corporation who maybe doesn't need the money as much because there's no family relationship. Like that doesn't make any sense in the spirit of what's trying to be done here, which is keep people working, keep businesses open, businesses paid. And then at the same time, tying in the payment mechanisms to the antiquated systems over at the IRS versus, you know, they could have done something like a grant program. They could have worked to create more safeguards for who was able to file these, tracking around filings, tracking around proof of eligibility, things like that, that the IRS did no due diligence on. Because, you know, in their mind, it's, well, this is a voluntary system. If somebody's filing, then that means they're, you know, they're stating that they're eligible for this versus, you know, like get with reality. Business owners aren't going to know all these rules. And because there's no tech, you know, there's no requirement around who can sign a tax return for somebody or, you know, people just being ghost preparers, which I see quite a bit. You're not doing those businesses a favor by just saying, oh, well, you should know better. It's really unfair to them, especially when you're dealing with a program that's unique, you know, it's a one-time thing. So it's just been very frustrating seeing how this has been administrated. And then too, the amount of delays that taxpayers have faced in this program have just been extremely frustrating. And also just, you know, the governmental waste that's been in this program because of the allowance for all the erroneous filings. You know, they ended up paying out three times what they initially budgeted for this program. And even though the IRS has said, you know, they're spotting, I think they're at like $3 billion of suspicious, like confirmed suspicious activity, that ticker is just going to go up and up and up and up based on what I've seen, if they're going to enforce this to the letter of the law.
Catherine, let the listeners know how they can reach you and your website, how they can reach out to you from phone number. On your website, I believe you have, do you have the link to your webinar on your website?
Yeah, so the best way to get in touch with us is through our website. So the firm is Dominion Enterprise Services. Our website is Dominion, and then E as in elephant, S as in Sam.com. I'm sure it'll be in the show notes. And then on there, you can get access to that webinar. There's also a bunch of resources and ways to get in touch with us. And then also, you know, that we have a newsletter where I put out updates on things and more educational resources. And then for people, for tax professionals who are interested in this conversation on a more day-to-day scale, I'm very active on LinkedIn. So you can get connected with me on LinkedIn as well, where I post updates and thoughts about things, you know, as I encounter client challenges and that sort of thing. But we are doing a lot of work with resolution in this space. And for, you know, the main people that we work with is where, you know, the tax professional is spotting that something's off, but they don't necessarily have the expertise or the personnel or the willingness to get involved to get it corrected or, you know, to get it in a position where the client can be really comfortable that they were eligible for the money that they got. So we come in and do, you know, an analysis to see, is there anything that needs to change in this situation? Was it appropriate? What happened? And then if so, how do we deal with that in the most tactful way, given the current environment? You know, letting the client know kind of what their exposure level is with, you know, different positions that were taken and getting them in a position where they can be comfortable with the filing and know kind of what their exposure is and how it can get corrected. And we also do all those, you know, corrected filings and that sort of thing.
I don't know anyone who's doing exactly what you're doing at this point. Just the name of your webinar, Escape the Coming ERC Nightmare, that's your message. And yeah, what you're providing as your service is sounds more like a purpose here for our profession, as well as the taxpayer who's going to be affected. I mean, the ripple effect here is can be either a nightmare, or people can actually sleep at night. So I encourage anyone to reach out to you on your website. I have my New England Tax Relief website and my Patricia L. Gentile Coaching website, and both my resource pages on those websites are going to have your website up there, a website link, so people can go and get to you as well. I want to thank you so much for the time you spent and this information you've put out here today, because you could have saved so many people who are listening to this now have an idea that there's hope there about, mm-hmm. you know, knowing to go to someone who actually can help them look at this properly and be either rest assured or come up, like you said, with a resolution for them to correct it. And that's very important in terms of this landscape right now, where mm-hmm. the voluntary disclosure program has been currently stopped. We don't know what the legislations could be about when the program ends, when they're going to lift this moratorium and really start processing what's already in the backlog. There's just so much going on. You know, people are better off at least being ready, being prepared, or knowing how to resolve right now, or saying we did fine.
Yep. It's a matter of catching it quickly and just knowing when there's a red flag, you know, making that initial check on it and saying, you know what, this doesn't smell right. This is kind of off. We need to dig a little deeper here. Yeah. You know, if I can get people to come away from this with that mentality of just, you know, give everything the sniff test at least. You know, we've got that due diligence checklist.
Thank you very much, Captain. I'll talk with you soon.
Sounds good.
You know, I truly believe that we're drowning in information and starving for wisdom. And so I want you to know that peace of mind for you and your clients can start today. And when you know you're doing the absolute best by your client, everyone wins. So find that confidence with me as your coach. Let's talk. Go to my website and contact me at patricialgentilecoaching.com.